From Illinois Public Media, this is The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. In Illinois, as in other states, there are many towns and cities with what are known as crime-free housing ordinances. The idea is to keep drugs and other illegal activity out of apartment buildings and other rental properties. If a place is found to be problematic, authorities can lean on the landlord to evict the tenant in question. But an investigation by the Illinois Answers Project found that in towns across Illinois, people have been evicted not for violent crimes, but for allegations as minor as speeding or even making too many calls to 911 for help. Critics say the ordinances disproportionately target low-income families and people of color, while supporters of the law say the programs ensure safety and have helped revitalize struggling neighborhoods. Today, three perspectives on crime-free housing laws. Later in the show, we'll hear from a critic of the rules who actually worked on legislation meant to address some of the problems identified in the report. We'll also talk with a retired police officer who's an advocate for these ordinances. But first, Sydney King is the journalist behind the story I mentioned. It's called Under Crime-Free Housing Laws, Families May Be Evicted for Minor Offenses. She joins us now. Sydney, welcome to the 21st Show.
Hi, Brian. Thanks for having me.
Listeners, if you have questions or comments as we talk today, you're welcome to join us at 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. All right, Sydney, what first put you on to this story?
Yeah, a couple of years ago, in the fall of 2023, I spoke with a woman who lived in a suburb of Chicago. It's called Ridgeton Park. She ended up suing her municipality because she and her family, she lived with her elder mother and two young children. They were evicted from a single family home that they were renting in town after they called the police a number of times following a shooting that happened on their street. They were ultimately victims of harassment after reporting the shooting. And they think that it was the shooters who later drove by and shot into their home. And the city told them that because of the calls that they'd made to police, they'd made an unreasonably high amount of calls and violated the city's crime-free housing ordinance. And they had 10 days to get out of their house. They left their single family home and moved into an apartment that was much smaller. And you know, when I learned of their story, I spoke with a woman, her name is Diamond Jones. I was shocked to hear that was even a possibility, that it was a process that was legal in Illinois. And I wanted to know if there were more stories like it across the state.
How does this actually work? Is the city kicking people out? Is it putting pressure on the landlord? I've heard different examples in different places.
Yeah, so it is rare for the city itself to write an eviction notice to the tenant. There's question around whether or not that's even actually legal for the city to do. But typically what the process is landlords, property owners either have to have a license or sign some sort of contract coming into compliance with the city's crime-free housing ordinance. And if it's found that their tenants have violated the ordinance by being arrested, by in some cases calling for emergency services too many times, what the city does is they send the landlord a notice saying, hey, your tenant has violated this ordinance, which puts you out of compliance. You need to abate this nuisance. You need to fix the problem, or we're going to fine you. It could be typically between $700 and $1,000 a day, or you could lose your license. You could lose the right to rent in the city altogether.
And so this is not exclusively public housing or private housing. It could be either or both.
Correct. Yeah. Typically in a lot of the cities that we looked at, the ordinances are compulsory. So landlords who own private properties must comply. Some cities do have voluntary programs. And then in those cities that have the compulsory programs, they also apply to public housing. And public housing authorities also typically have their own rules associated with criminal activity. But it applies to all types of housing. That's one of the things that I found was often a misconception. People think that it applies to, you know, just public housing, but people who live in single family homes, who live in high-rise complexes, who live in smaller low-income complexes, it applies to people from all walks of life.
What problem are these ordinances trying to solve? I mean, they didn't come from nowhere, right?
I mean, I think that the origins of the ordinances were well-intentioned. The origins go back to a police department in Arizona in the 80s. A guy named Tim Ziering sort of saw that his department was having a hard time closing crimes that were centered around rental properties. And so they worked on a program to sort of engage the landlords. And it was intended that they could work together to sort of keep problem tenants out of rental property. I mean, the idea is, nobody wants to live next door to somebody who is repeatedly being arrested or is engaged in activity that could be dangerous to everyone in the community. And so when the ordinances started coming to Illinois, that ethos, that idea was the same, right? No, police departments wanted to ensure that rental properties were free of the concern, that people are living next door to drug dealers or people who are committing violent crime. But over time, the ordinances and the enforcement thereof evolved into something that was affecting people who may not have been part of that original target demographic.
That case you mentioned of Diamond Jones, who seemingly was just a victim of crime and just trying to get help. I think that is, that does stir the outrage in a lot of people. I wonder if you did talk to anyone though who says, you know what, this is actually, there are good cases for this, right? Nobody wants to live next door to a drug dealer, for example.
Certainly. And I think most municipalities would acknowledge that a Diamond Jones case is not what they would want the outcome of crime-free enforcement to look like. Richmond Park did amend their ordinance after the lawsuit with Diamond Jones. And we did find, so in our investigation, we looked at more than 2,000 cases over the course of 5 years, and we did find a third of those cases applied to criminal activity that was serious, for felony offenses, for violent crime. And so, I've spoken to a lot of police chiefs, a lot of crime-free housing officers who run these programs, and they bring up cases where, reasonably anybody would want that person to not live in the household anymore. I've talked to landlords who acknowledge that in certain counties in Illinois, specifically Cook County, it takes a really long time to evict someone through the court. It can take up to 6 to 7 months, and when you have someone who, could be selling drugs or endangering the lives of other tenants, you don't want to wait that long. And so some of the landlords were very appreciative to have the support of the police department in their effort to get tenants out.
You said that two, or I should say one third, I'm trying to do my half glass full, half empty here, or a glass half full. So if one third of the cases were sort of legitimate, that suggests two thirds were at least questionable. What are some of the patterns you saw that might jump out to you?
The other two thirds of the cases, it was a little over 1,300, were for misdemeanor offenses or for non-criminal offenses. And I think this is the thing that's interesting about crime-free housing laws is, determining the legitimacy of the enforcement is incredibly subjective, right? For example, we spoke with a woman. Her name was Catherine. She was arrested for a DUI. She was a bartender out in Tinley Park, was on her way home, got pulled over, and was arrested for a DUI. After her arrest, the city immediately notified her landlord that she could have potentially violated the city's crime-free housing ordinance, and she was kicked out of her house. She went to trial for the arrest and was eventually found not guilty. But it was too late in terms of her housing. The damage was already done. And so, many people might look at a DUI case and say, well, that is dangerous. Like you're putting other people at risk. But the question there is, did she have due process? Was there the opportunity for her to be proven not guilty before her housing was revoked? And so we saw a lot of cases like that where the eviction or the enforcement happened before the justice process, the criminal justice process, even began. And then there are other cases where, people were evicted for really, really small offenses, for, like I mentioned, calling the police too many times, for help, for noise complaints, for all manner of things. So it really is a wide range of offenses, and it ultimately comes down to, the decision making of a handful of municipal leaders to decide whether or not people get to stay in their homes.
There was legislation this spring, Senate Bill 2264, sponsored by State Senator Corina Villa, a Democrat. I should say we were hoping to have her on the program. Her schedule did not allow that, but it would have put some limits on these ordinances, basically saying that, correct me if I'm wrong, but counties cannot penalize people for seeking help. From what your reporting taught you about this issue, do you think that would have been effective in addressing some of the problems that advocates have identified with these laws?
Yeah, I mean, I definitely do think that that would have been an effective start of the conversation. A big part of the question around whether or not people should be evicted or threatened with eviction for calling emergency services is we're then putting residents in a position between calling for help and choosing their housing. One challenge with these ordinances is survivors of domestic violence, right? People who, might be in a continued situation where they need to call the police department for help. I've spoken with caseworkers and advocates, and individuals who say, sometimes a woman who's living in an abusive household might decide not to call the police because she knows that if she does, she could get evicted. Technically, it is illegal to do that, but because of the way that these laws are written, that's not actually what's happening. In reality.
Sydney King is a journalist with the Illinois Answers Project. Her story was titled Under Crime-Free Housing Laws, Families May Be Evicted for Minor Offenses. Sydney, thanks so much for sharing your reporting with us today on the 21st Show.
Of course, thank you for having me.
And we're going to continue this conversation with two different perspectives now on these ordinances. If you want to join us, 800-222-9455 is the number. 800-222-9455. In a few minutes later on the program, we'll hear from a supporter of these laws, but we turn now to Emily Coffey, an attorney with the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. She helped work on the legislation that we were just talking about. Emily, welcome to the 21st Show.
Thanks for having me.
Maybe we can just pick up right where we left off with Sydney, which is this question of domestic violence. This is already something that's supposed to be addressed in Illinois law, right? Can you speak to that?
Yeah, that's right. So there are many existing laws already on the books that are supposed to restrict these ordinances. In Illinois specifically, a decade ago, our state passed a law that said that crime-free ordinances cannot be enforced against survivors of domestic violence, against survivors of sexual violence, and against people with disabilities. You just heard multiple examples from Sydney about how that is continuing to happen. And that is despite, a law being required that local governments are not enforcing these ordinances against this community.
Who are most affected by these ordinances, in your understanding?
These ordinances are really part of our legacy of segregation in this country. A lot of these ordinances were initially passed because of a perceived or actual change in demographics in a local community. And as a result of that, the people who are most impacted are Black and Latinx communities. We also know that anybody who is seeking police assistance is targeted by these ordinances, because many of them write into their laws that causing an unreasonably high number of calls for police services is a triggering event, and that's what we saw with Diamond Jones' example, as Sydney just described. These ordinances are really problematic from a number of perspectives, and that is why it is just so important that we work as a state to better regulate them.
We need to take a break in about a minute here, but and we'll continue after that. But I understand that people with disabilities also can be affected by these. There was even one example of a, I don't know if you can speak to that, of somebody with a whose child, I believe, had intellectual disabilities and just kept calling police.
Yeah, so there are many examples of people with disabilities being impacted by these ordinances. There is a recent example that was highlighted actually in Sydney's reporting, where a mother was calling and and her son with developmental disabilities was repeatedly calling the police for help, and as a result of that, the local government went after her family, and they were required to move away from their home.
And this is
something that we have seen in other jurisdictions as well.
All right. We are going to talk more about the legislation that was floated this spring. It did not ultimately pass, but things can always come back in Illinois. And we will continue this conversation on crime-free housing laws. You're welcome to join us if you have questions or comments the next 15 minutes or so. 800-222-9455 is the number. This is The 21st Show. It's The 21st Show. I'm Brian Mackey. We are talking about crime-free housing laws, or ordinances, I should say. Towns and cities have them. They're meant to protect renters from bad neighbors, basically, people who do crimes in their apartments. But as we heard, there have been cases of people being evicted just for seeking help from authorities. Later in the program, we'll hear from someone who supports these laws, but we continue now with Emily Coffey, an attorney at the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. She helped work on the legislation we have been talking about that was meant to address some of the problems people have identified with these laws. If you want to join us today, 800-222-9455 is the number, 800-222-9455. So let's talk about that legislation. I think I mentioned Senate Bill 2264. People will have a link to this on our website if people want to check it out for themselves, 21stshow.org. But what was this meant to do?
Yeah, so this bill is meant to really regulate these ordinances and make sure that all local governments are following basic due process protections and are making sure that they are only enforcing these ordinances when it is most important that they do so. So one thing that this ordinance does is what this bill does is it prohibits calls for emergency services as being one of the bases for enforcement. It also prohibits using just the mere fact that somebody has been arrested as sufficient evidence to move forward with their eviction. And it also would protect family members who are innocent of what conduct may have occurred by another household member. The bill also would protect landlords who are often put into an impossible situation where the city is requiring that they move forward with an eviction, but the tenant is not somebody that they want to move forward with evicting, and they actually are risking, you know, violating civil rights laws if they do move forward with that eviction. So it would provide some protection for landlords. And it would also require that tenants receive a 30-day notice and a neutral hearing before a tenant could be evicted under one of these ordinances. And it would require some basic transparency in terms of local governments having to review the types of enforcement actions that they take and go through some basic required training. So none of these things are currently required under state law. And so it's time that we as a state move forward with regulating them to prevent the types of abuses that Sydney's reporting has uncovered.
Can you speak to, so I was looking through the legislative website on this, and there were a lot of municipal representatives. The Illinois Municipal League itself, I think, put in, notified legislators that they were opposed to this legislation. Maybe you can address some of the concerns you heard from people who were opposed to this, and why you think you would persuade them to see it your way.
Yeah, I mean, we heard from a lot of local governments and from the Municipal League that we only have outlying examples, that this is not something that is regularly happening, that we are doing, that advocates are doing a great job of raising examples when there are bad actors out there, and that all of that is making its way through the legal system. And that is really just not the case. What this ordinance or what this bill would do is it would regulate these ordinances and bring them all into compliance with very basic constitutional protections. And that is something that every local government should strive to be doing. And I think that there is a lot of common ground with local governments. I have personally negotiated with a lot of local governments that are thinking about enacting these ordinances and actually choose another way. And so I see that there is potential for some common ground here, but the bottom line is that the state needs to step up and do some basic regulation to prevent these abuses from continuing.
What do you say to the advocates who say, you know, these ordinances do make communities safer? They allow communities to have, not have crime in their neighborhoods, right? Neighborhoods that I guess we euphemistically call troubled sometimes. What do you say in response to that?
Sure. I guess my main question is how this is actually addressing the root cause of any of those problems. Once you evict somebody, where are they going? Are they just going to the next town over that doesn't have a crime-free ordinance? That's one of the reasons why these ordinances have proliferated across our state, is that one local government has one of these ordinances, and then they're fearful that somebody who actually has committed a serious a crime is then going to be forced to move to the next town over. And without one of these ordinances, what are they going to do? So that's why we need state level protections and state level regulation of these ordinances. How does this really get to the bottom of any of the issues that these ordinances are purporting to solve if all you're doing is moving forward with evicting people, which we know based on the evidence, just destabilizes people further and can have the impact of actually increasing public safety issues.
As I was going down the rabbit hole in preparation for this conversation today, I was reading somewhere, I think it might have been on the ACLU's website, that there are even people who think there are constitutional issues with some of these ordinances, right? We have a constitutional right to petition, what is the phrase? Petition the government for redress or something along
That's
those
right.
lines. Are there efforts underway, or has this been settled in the courts that these are constitutional?
Yeah, so in the example that Sydney raised earlier with Diamond Jones in Richton Park, the basis for that lawsuit was under the First Amendment, the right to petition, as you just described. So that's our basic First Amendment right to call our government and ask that they do something, right? And that lawsuit also challenged the 14th Amendment's due process requirements because Ms. Jones had absolutely no process to challenge the way that the village was enforcing the ordinance against her. And so these are basic constitutional requirements, and there have been cases that have moved to challenge these ordinances as a result. And so that's why when we talk with local governments about ensuring that they don't move forward with enacting an unlawful ordinance, that is one of the many reasons why a local government should think twice about creating one of these programs.
So the legislation in question did pass the Senate Executive Committee. It was a 9-4 vote. It did not come up on the floor of the Senate before legislators adjourned for the spring session. What's next for this effort?
Yeah, I think we, as a coalition of advocates, are working to regather and figure out what our next steps are for the next legislative session. There's always a lot of bills that are competing for attention at the end of session rush, but this is an issue that needs to be addressed by our state.
Emily Coffey is an attorney with the Chicago Lawyers Committee for Civil Rights. Thank you so much for being with us today on the 21st Show.
Thank you.
And I'm Brian Mackey. This is The 21st Show. We're talking about crime-free housing laws, which are meant to protect renters from bad neighbors, basically, people who do crime in their apartments. But as we've heard, there have been cases, many cases, of people being evicted for misdemeanor offenses, accusations of crime, not convictions, or even just seeking help from the police. For another perspective on this issue, we're joined now by Mike Bansky, who is president of the Illinois Crime Free Association. That group supports crime free housing ordinances. Mike, welcome to the 21st Show. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you, Brian. I appreciate the opportunity to give the other side of the argument here.
Absolutely. So maybe we can just start with your sort of elevator pitch for these kinds of rules, right? Let's say you're meeting a city official for the first time. They're considering one of these ordinances. What is your best, sort of briefcase for enacting them?
Well, it does create a great partnership with the local government, the police department, landlords, and their tenants. And we try to educate landlords with the training class that are mandatory for all landlords to take, during which time we cover a myriad of topics. I myself work in a municipality that is within Cook County. And so even like with Cook County, we've got just housing amendment, we've got RTLO ordinances, and a lot of things that landlords in our areas seem to have missed out on hearing about. But when they come to training courses, those are things that they are in fact informed about. So our landlords are operating a business the way it's intended to be run by all of these regulations. And it allows the municipalities to have some controls on things because we may not be able to pick and choose who's living here, obviously, but, we do have to hold landlords accountable for decisions that they would make. And so through enforcement actions that are available, we would obviously be able to have those landlords to doing the job that they've signed up to do. It's not an easy job. And Springfield makes a lot of regulations that makes it more difficult. When you look at property taxes, people are paying pretty big money. You have tenants in some cases that are tearing people's properties apart and not paying rent. So these landlords, they have a lot on their plate. And I'll tell you, nearly every landlord that I've ever taught, which is probably in the neighborhood of about 800 landlords, they're all very appreciative that this training course is available for them. They appreciate the local municipalities are trying to work with them to ensure a better opportunity to get better tenants. Because if you don't do something that's purposeful and intentional to try to help that out, it's kind of a roll of the dice, Brian, on who's going to come and apply to rent from your property.
Sure. So let's talk about this legislation that came up this spring. Your organization, I believe, was opposed to it, at least as in the form it was being considered at the time. What were some of your some of the dot points of your objections to that?
Well, I testified at the hearing back on May 14th, and I kind of outlined a lot of the objections we have. Some of the things we do agree on, like Emily had mentioned, and I think Sydney also mentioned, we do have some common points that we would obviously not want to have crime-free programs doing. And on that topic, Brian, I'll just make a note that there are some towns that run a program, but it may not be the actual crime-free housing program, which is a pretty big difference.
They're freelancing it, you're saying.
Right. They run something that involves the police or a building department. They obviously are working with a licensing of landlords and their properties. And, it falls under this generic term, crime-free housing. And in some cases, that's what I've discovered. In other cases, there are people that are running a program that has obviously been found to be incorrectly and illegally run, such as the Richland Park case that's been mentioned. And those are things that are already been adjudicated for their wrongdoings. Those are those exceptions to how crime-free housing is supposed to be run. But back to the legislation part, one of the
Sure, and I
things
do
that
want to just be conscious of time. We have about 3.5 minutes remaining. So, yeah, go ahead.
I'll put it into some perspective here. Some of the things like the hearing, the 30 days for a hearing, an unofficial hearing, that sounds like a great idea, but none of the information that would be shared at the hearing would be admissible in an actual eviction case. So for a landlord to go through a 30 days process for this unofficial hearing, whatever would be shared at that unofficial hearing would be inadmissible in the actual hearing itself. So it kind of begs the question, why have that 30-day delayed process in an eviction process that actually in Cook County, just to correct a misstatement from Ms. King, Cook County evictions are taking at least 8 months, if not more than a year, for a landlord to get their property back. Not 6 months, but 8 months to a year to get their property back. So adding an additional step into a process is only adding more time to a landlord who's not even probably getting paid rent on top of the problems those tenants are committing.
So, yeah, like maybe we can talk about it, like in sort of, wrap up on a big picture note here. Surely there is a path that balances housing safety and landlord rights and tenant rights, right? What does that look like in your view?
Well, it's working together. And, with the legislation, the Illinois Crime Free Association's never been, asked to the table to talk about this legislation. It's just been kind of a one-sided, this is what we want kind of thing. We do have some mutual greeting points, and there are, as Emily had mentioned, there are a lot of existing laws already on the books that, regulate these things, which is why towns like Richland Park have in fact been adjudicated with high fines. One thing we have to keep in mind, Brian, is that landlords need to have an ability to try to expedite an eviction if that's what needs to happen for criminal activity. We have to separate nuisance issues from criminal issues, and that's what gets crime-free housing programs or anything similar. That's what gets them into trouble. We shouldn't, let me put it that way. We shouldn't be evicting somebody on a nuisance issue where there's calls for service or, mental health evaluations where an ambulance gets called. What we should be held to is a standard that's already in existing law, which is criminal statute 735 ILCS. I just pulled it up here. It is a statute that regulates an eviction can be based on Class A misdemeanor crimes or any felony crime. And then it expedites the hearing process and the order of possession. That should be what we work towards, is using that piece of legislation to guide anybody that's going to be, having their lease terminated.
Sure. All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Mike Banski is president of the Illinois Crime Free Association. Thank you for being here today. Appreciate your time.
Well, thank you very much, Brian, and thank you, Sydney and Emily, for your work as well.
We're going to take a break here on the 21st show. Before we do, I want to mention this afternoon we're taping an interview with Illinois U.S. Senator Tammy Duckworth. If you have a question for her, let us know. You can figure out how to do that on our website, 21stshow.org. Stay with us.